Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. I want to take you to this cool science museum. It's called Your Kitchen. It's very interactive, totally approachable. You can even eat there.
Welcome to Your Kitchen. Please touch and use objects to learn more.
All right, I see a refrigerator.
Pull on the handle to begin interactive exhibit.
Okay, let's get some eggs.
Refrigerators became more common in American households after Freon was discovered in 1928. It consists of chlorofluorocarbons. Before that,
you can turn on a gas stove over there.
Please maintain a safe distance as you turn the knob. You will see a blue flame as the gas ignites.
When you turn the knob, it opens the intake valve. The gas flows through a Venturi tube, a wide pipe that narrows in the middle. Gas enters through one.
There is a microwave. You can heat up some coffee if you want, or tea.
In the 1940s, American engineer Percy Spencer was working to develop microwave radar transmitters at Raytheon, and then noticed that the microwave had melted
Scientists
a candy bar in his pocket.
Gas contributed to the depletion of the H8.
The material that brings us every day
of carton and gas.
And the blender was more.
Think about any object in your life, the stuff in your kitchen, the phone in your pocket, your car, your bike. These everyday things are the result of scientific discovery and innovation. They hold tales of dogged pursuit and occasional lucky breaks. On this episode of The Pulse, a closer look at our stuff and the hidden science that fuels our daily lives. Let's start with bicycles. I ride a bike to work most days. Close to a million Americans commute that way. And here's a fun fact. An early version of the bicycle was invented in my hometown, Karlsruhe, Germany. This happened in 1817. This early bike had no pedals, and the frame was made from wood. Later came cast iron and steel frames, but these days high-end bikes have zoomed into the space age. They're sleek, light, super fast, but the question is whether they are as durable as the old steel horses I see chained up all over my neighborhood. Which bikes are made for the long haul? We sent Jad Slayman to find out.
You're hearing my 80s-era DeBarnardi road bike. It's a steel frame and gray, but that's hidden under about 200 stickers. It has the type of down tube shifters that went out of fashion around the fall of the Berlin Wall. I'm headed out to see the cycling cutting edge at the Philly Bike Expo. As I walk around the stalls and chat up vendors, I keep hearing about a material more commonly associated with the aerospace industry.
Carbon fiber.
Carbon.
Pi modules, carbon fiber.
Full carbon, carbon tubes, carbon lugs. The whole frame is all carbon.
It's a lightweight composite that's remarkably strong and getting cheaper every year. The first guy I spoke with was Nolan Bixler. He was working at the stall for Bianchi, a well-known Italian bike manufacturer.
It's a carbon fiber that was originally made for NASA and satellites.
NASA comes up a lot at this expo.
So in space, you know, you have a satellite and its arm opens up with kind of that non-gravity thing that's going on out there, you can get a lot of vibration. So these, they stop the vibration as it happens.
We're standing in front of a half dozen bikes painted signature Bianchi blue. Most of their frames are entirely carbon. One is aluminum and another is steel. An analyst tells me the larger US bike market is different. Most bikes are steel, the heaviest of the three materials. But that's thanks to a glut of children's department store bikes. Next is aluminum, which is often paired with some carbon parts. And then full carbon frames. Their smaller market share is growing as the tech gets cheaper and mass production ramps up in Asia.
Which one of these bikes is still going to be on the road in 30 years, most likely?
Honestly, all of them.
I'm interested in the durability of the carbon bikes. I try lifting one up and manage using only two fingers. That's the entire assembled bike, with wheels, pedals, handlebar, and all.
What's the repairability on this thing? I mean, if it takes a pretty serious hit.
Nolan sells bikes, but he's also a mechanic.
So, carbon, not gonna bend, totally gonna break. We actually have a bike in the shop right now where the seats stay here, took an impact. You can see the paint chipping, it's cracked, you push on it, it's got a little bit of a dead feeling.
Engineers tell me Nolan was seeing carbon fibers that had broken free from their polymer matrix, a kind of glue that holds them in place. Nolan has to send those fixes off to a specialist out west, and it gets expensive.
You can get a full carbon fiber bike for about $2,000. If it costs $700, $800 to repair one part of the frame, you can argue that you may just go get a replacement bike.
Okay, sure. If you've got an extra $2,000 to spend, that's fine. But I want to talk to riders who can't afford to replace their bikes, who need them to last no matter what. So I head downtown to a park where bike couriers hang out between calls. I know where to find them because I used to be one of them, weaving through traffic on delivery runs. The faster you were, the more you earned. Bike couriers are easy to spot, mostly young guys with bulky satchels over their shoulders, with a kind of punk vibe.
Just kind of introduce yourself, your full name, what you do, where you're from.
I'm not gonna give you my full name.
Oh, whatever you're comfortable with.
All right, cool.
That's Ozzy. He's been a courier for 4 years. He only gives his first name because of a recent run-in with the law after running a red light.
And then they told me to pull over. No lights, no siren. I said, no problem. And then after I said, no problem, I got tackled off my bike.
Ozzy needs a bike that he can rely on because cycling is much more than a hobby for him.
I use my bike to feed my family, dude. I know I look young, but I'm 30 years old. I have 5 kids, man.
That means he logs at least 100 miles every work week. And that's not counting the 16-mile round trip he bikes just to get downtown.
When you're working on your bike, as opposed to commuting on your bike, you need parts that's gonna last you, you know, when you're putting that wear and tear on your bike, putting all those miles on your bike.
Ozzy, like most of his colleagues, rides steel, and he sees carbon and aluminum as impractical luxuries.
Yeah, it's lighter, yeah, you're faster on it, but I would literally tear all the guts apart on that frame.
The occasional crash is also part of the job. Ozzy got doored 2 weeks ago.
I went over my handlebars and over the door. And when I turned around, my bicycle was vertical, nose down, in between two cars. But it was perfectly fine.
Ozzy says a courier's bike endures in a year what a commuter's bike might face over a lifetime. For guys like him, that means there's no substitute for steel.
Steel frames all day, dude.
Engineers explain this by pointing out two properties of steel. It has high ductility, that is, it bends well before it breaks. And it has very high toughness, meaning it's resistant to cracks. I wanted to know more about what goes into a steel bike, so I went to see Steve Belenke of Belenke Cycle Works.
Yo, Steve!
Oh, hey. How are you?
Hey, I'm
Jed. Hey, I'm Jed from Public Radio. We spoke yesterday.
Steve's been making steel bikes for 35 years. His milling machines are the size of refrigerators, and most of them are from the 70s.
This machine is called a rotary dice wager. It looks like a submarine thing.
Steve is decidedly old school.
If I, my thought is the bike's not at least 25 years old. It hasn't really seen its life.
There's a certain kind of niche rider that wants Steve's type of bike, made in the old ways. But I have to ask what he thinks of newer models. Steve says, wreck a carbon bike, you no longer have a bike. And aluminum?
Well, aluminum, after enough use, that will probably get a crack somewhere. And it's usually not repairable because of the heat treatment.
Heat treating strengthens aluminum, but the trade-off is a loss of toughness, resistance to cracks. So Steve, he's also steel frames all day. And his machines allow him to make bikes the way they were made a half century ago, with steel tubes connected at socket-like lugs to make the frame. Picture an Erector set. You can bring a bike like that back to life.
I have a bike right now from the 80s hanging in there that's finished. Two tubes were bent, and now it looks like a brand new bicycle again.
And being able to repair a bike means being able to keep a bike as the decades come and go.
After a good amount of miles, a good amount of years, the bike, A, has a certain look and patina, but really, it's the connection to the rider that what they've done with the bike. Could be a special bike that was once a high-end race bike, but now it's more of a antique. But for that person, it's the bike that they went to college on.
That story was reported by Jad Slayman. We're talking about the science attached to everyday objects today, from bikes to cars, and something that really annoys me about cars, the carpet. My car always looks disgusting, like a squirrel lives in there or something. And I do try to vacuum it, it's just impossible. Can science explain why carpets and cars are so hard to clean? I thought Alan Yu would be the perfect person to look into this, but he doesn't own a car, so I told him, try cleaning my car. I mean, I am his boss.
All right, so my first stop is at a gas station with Mikan's car. There's a coin-operated vacuum cleaner. First, I have to assess the damage.
So I see scraps of leaves, what looks like grass, what looks like the wrapping on a toothpick package. It's not the dirtiest car I've ever seen. 4, 5, 6.
Okay, I start to see what Mikan is talking about. Even though I worked hard to drag the vacuum nozzle over the carpet still isn't entirely clean. But obviously I'm not a professional, so next I go to a car detailing place where all they do is clean cars.
Hi, you Michelle?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Alan.
Nice to meet you. Yep.
Michelle Fuscalero at JoJo's Professional Auto Detailing says that beyond leaves and crumbs, there are some things that are really hard to get off a carpet.
Fruit punch, like high C, stuff like that. Gatorade, red crayon. If you leave it in a car, it could actually melt and dye the rug.
For stuff like that, they sometimes just dye the carpet to get it back to its original color. Okay, even the pros struggle with these carpets, and that brings me to my next question. Is there some reason why carpets in cars are so hard to clean? I took a road trip to Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, to visit a factory where these things are made. It's owned by a company called Autoneum, so I'm entering the place where car carpets are born. Jim Nemeth, the Director of Human Resources, shows me around.
Well, you need safety glasses, a visitor's vest, and toe caps because we have to wear safety shoes.
It feels a little funny walking in these shoes.
Oh, I know.
It gives me kind of an extra bounce when I...
I hate them. So I have.
I mean, they're not bad.
I have steel-toed shoes.
Once I'm inside, Jim explains that broadly speaking, there are two kinds of carpet in cars. The nicer, more high-end cars like a Cadillac or a Mercedes will have something called tufted carpet. It's more like your carpet at home. He walks me to the part of the factory where that kind of carpet is being made. Imagine a sewing machine with thousands of needles all in a straight line, and each of those pulling a line of yarn.
See all the spools of thread, they're all feed up through these tubes, come down.
The needles punch through a base layer. Then a row of knives cut the thread, so you end up with thousands of bits of yarn sticking up vertically. Okay, that's a tufted carpet. It should be easier to clean because the holes between the fibers are bigger, so you can use a vacuum cleaner to suck up crumbs and dirt. But in the past few years, some car makers have moved to a different kind of carpet, made from ground-up plastic.
Three ground-up pop bottles. This died.
We found the what bottles?
Water bottles, you know those plastic water bottles?
They get giant bales of ground up recycled bottles. Jim lets me touch some. It's soft but also wiry. It feels a little like clumps of cotton. This plastic is put through rollers that make it really flat. Then thousands of barbed needles stab this flat layer to tangle the fibers. And you end up with what's called a needle punch carpet. It's kind of like carpet, but it's dense, and the holes between the fibers are much smaller. So if crumbs and dirt get trapped in there, it's going to be really hard to get that stuff out. And it's become pretty common, and this is the kind of carpet that Mikan has in her car.
It's okay to put this lower performing carpet in a vehicle because nobody really cares.
That's John Michalakis. He's been making car carpets for decades at a different company. He says carpets have been in cars since the 1920s, in later varieties of the Ford Model T. But these days, cheaper carpets are one way to save money in the manufacturing process, because this is not something that people seem to care all that much about. And that brings me to my last question. Why do we have carpets at all? Jason Toczynski is not a fan.
Carpet just never made sense for me.
He's the senior editor at the car site Jalopnik.com.
Carpet is unforgiving. Carpet holds on to crap and dirt and filth, and carpet can get stained. It's just not something that deals well with the filthiness of the outside world.
He has a 1973 Volkswagen Beetle as one of his 6 cars, and that one comes with a rubber floor.
Vacuuming off a rubber mat is no big deal. Like, all kinds of stuff just goes up. But carpet grabs. Carpet grabs leaf, like bits of leaves and bark and bits of paper.
He says, yes, carpet feels good. They make the interior quieter, so that's nice. And it's what we have at home, but we're in a car.
For the most part, we keep our shoes on in our cars. You're not luxuriating your toes in the thick pile of your carpet, really.
And he says the 1973 Volkswagen Beetle is not the only car that has ever had a different floor material.
It's just nobody's really had the guts to go through and like make a mainstream passenger car with something other than carpet, at least not recently. I feel like so much of what stops people from doing that are these ideas that rubber is not premium enough. Like, I don't know when we all decided we were, you know, royalty worthy of, you know, being coddled every product we have and everything that we encounter has to be the absolute best, but it doesn't always. Sometimes the best isn't the most luxurious. Sometimes it's the thing that just does its job the best.
Jason says some of the future designs that companies show off at car shows have bamboo floors. The new VW bus might ship with one, which he is excited about. But until more car makers decide to use new materials, we're stuck with carpet.
Like, why doesn't this come up? Ugh. It's just frustrating because it doesn't look like really clean.
Thank you, Alan Yu, for checking into this for us and also for trying to vacuum my car. Let's listen back to a story by Todd Bookman, which starts with an annoying overabundance of yarn.
In the corner of my apartment, my two-room apartment, mind you, there sits this rectangular cart. It's a few feet high on caster wheels. It wouldn't look out of place in a coal mine, but instead, this one is filled with yarn. All the yarn my wife has accumulated over the years. Balls of yarn, skeins of yarn, different materials, different weights, colors. The cart is an eyesore. I hate that we've moved with it several times, that it takes up so much space. She knows I hate this cart. But the winter before last, unprompted, my wife digs into it, and she grabs up all the dark blue. And she sits next to me on the couch, and she starts to knit a sweater. And this wound up taking months. She'd stitch during car trips and during Sunday night football. And slowly, this garment began to take shape, a warm, well-made, custom-fit sweater, a sweater that I now love to wear. I still hate that yarn cart, but it was a good reminder of what our clothing actually is, how much design, labor, and attention goes into each article. And that little life lesson brings us to this.
And now, here is this week's story of DuPont Chemistry.
For thousands of years, we humans wore only natural fibers. Cotton, silk, leather, wool, linen. But a century ago, scientists at DuPont began to look into durable, low-cost, synthetic materials to make clothes with.
Well, starting in the 1920s, they decided to invest quite a bit in basic research to try and come up with these synthetic fibers from scratch.
This is Dr. Audra Wolfe, a Philadelphia-based historian of science.
And so by the mid-1930s, they had some good possibilities, and they settled on one that seemed to withstand heat pretty well and that wouldn't dissolve in water. This is a huge problem if you're going to launder clothes.
DuPont's invention was nylon, the world's first commercially successful synthetic fiber, a polymer made in the lab that would soon find its way into everyone's closets. The breakthrough came at the perfect time for the company, because in the 1930s, women's hemlines were starting to rise, and more women were entering the workforce. The hosiery market was booming, and DuPont went all in.
So nylon is a really great fabric to make hosiery with because it's relatively resilient. You can wash it. It's relatively resistant to run. I mean, any woman who's owned a pair of pantyhose knows that they do run eventually. And if you snag them, they run. But they're more resilient than some of the other options. And they were affordable. Silk hosiery was not inexpensive. More importantly, as the world situation was changing, it was becoming more and more difficult to get silk from Japan. So all of these things kind of came together when nylon was released in the late 1930s.
So was it an immediate hit?
It was an immediate hit. Nylon went on the national market in May 1940, and they were sold out by noon.
But the working women of America didn't have nylon for long. When World War II broke out, Uncle Sam sucked up all the nylon DuPont could crank out. The fiber found its way into parachutes and flak jackets and shoelaces. When the war ended, pent-up demand exploded in a way that's sort of hard to imagine today.
Well, people were so excited when it came back on the market. It came back on the market in 1945 in the consumer market. But by 1946, there were rumors and in some cases actual nylon riots. There's an amazing story from Pittsburgh in 1946 where 40,000 people lined up to get 13,000 pairs of pantyhose.
It can happen here, and here is the proof. On the run come the ladies to check a rumor that proves true. Free nylons just for the scramble. Yep, 600 pairs.
Today, nylon is still big business. But we're going to jump ahead about 25 years from those nylon riots to when another synthetic material arrived. And if you've ever gone hiking, you've worn it.
Well, my name is Bob Gore, and I've been working at this textile stuff for a long, long time.
Bob Gore is Gore-Tex, though he had an assist from his dad, Bill, who, coincidentally or maybe not, was also a DuPont researcher.
And there was a particular material that he thought DuPont was not paying enough attention to. And so that was what is known as Teflon now, but is scientifically called polytetrafluoroethylene.
When the elder Gore left DuPont and launched his own company, his focus was this material, abbreviated as PTFE. His first thought was a coating to apply to the bottom of skis, since Teflon is so non-stick. But that didn't work out. So instead, W.L. Gore and Associates began using the material in electrical wiring equipment, which it successfully marketed to IBM. A few years later, 1969, the younger Gore was tinkering with a rod made out of heated PTFE to see if he could make something else.
The vision was a very lowly vision. It was to make cheaper plumber's tape. So I always put that in when we think that visions have to be lofty. They sometimes are pretty mundane.
By rapidly stretching the PTFE at high temperatures, basically jerking it, Gore figured out a way to introduce air into the material. The result was this thin membrane-like substance that under a microscope looks like a spider web. The holes are small enough that they resist droplets of water, but the holes are big enough that water vapor, such as the sweat coming off of your body, can pass through it. It was the first waterproof, breathable material.
The Gore-Tex, as most people know it in garments, is a membrane that is adhered to a textile fabric.
Gore-Tex revolutionized hiking, camping, running shoes, boots, and it also found its way into medical devices, astronaut suits, even dental floss. The company is still rolling out new uses for it.
Where there's human ingenuity, there's going to be progress.
Scientists are now working on next-generation fibers, things that can follow in nylon and Gore-Tex's footprint, functional fabrics that could someday let a soldier know when he's at risk from chemical weapons, or allow a Navy SEAL to carry more battery power for his GPS unit without carrying extra weight. And the idea is these innovations will eventually trickle down into a range of consumer goods. Jean-Vieve Dion is spearheading a team at Drexel University in Philadelphia that develops new functional textiles.
Functional fabric is one of the most transdisciplinary fields of our time, right? So you need material scientists, you need modelers, you need mechanical engineers, you need designers, you need system integration, you need electrical engineering, you need all the fields.
These are early days in the pursuit of next-generation materials. There are still lots of technical challenges to work out. And, you know, nobody's going to want to look like they're wearing a circuit board.
I think the day that we will be really, really successful with functional fabric is when you do not know they're there. So our goal is to be invisible in a way.
Invisible, in the same way that nylon hosiery just looks like hosiery. And a Gore-Tex jacket doesn't look all that futuristic. My dark blue sweater, handmade with wool yarn, isn't smart, it isn't synthetic, and it isn't good in the rain. But it is a piece of clothing, an arrangement of fibers carefully assembled that means a great deal to me. It's perhaps the only thing that when I wear it, I know exactly all that went into it. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
We're talking about the science of everyday things. Let's stick to this topic of clothes and discuss keeping them clean. Here's an example. So my daughter wears uniforms to school, and on Fridays she has to wear a white polo shirt, and they call this their Friday best.
This is my Friday best shirt?
Yeah. And what happened to it?
Spots and dots?
Stains?
It's sort of white with the gray or tannish?
And the weird thing is, these stains appeared after I washed the shirt. So I was wondering, is my washing machine making the shirt dirty, or is there some kind of weird reaction going on with the detergent? I asked chemist Curtis Schwartz to stop by.
I've been working in the chemical industry for 32 years.
Curtis is retired now, but he did a lot of work researching the best formulas for laundry detergents. He told me finding weird spots on clothes you just washed used to be pretty standard.
Before the 1940s, the laundry detergents were essentially soap chips. They weren't very effective in hard water. They left a residue on the clothes. But with synthetic surfactants, there was a real step change in cleaning improvements.
What is a synthetic surfactant?
It's the main active ingredient in detergents. And what they do is they get in between the soil and the fabric so you can dislodge the soil from the fabric.
So let's say I'm wearing a shirt.
Yes.
And I just dropped some tomato sauce on it,
oh.
Right? So now I'm putting the shirt into the washing machine, and then what's the job of the surfactant?
Okay, the surfactant goes between the fabric and the tomato sauce to essentially make it non-adhesive so it can be dislodged from the fabric and then redispersed in the wash water so the agitation of the laundry, of the wash water, can remove it away. So it makes it slippery. Just like when you wash dishes, it gets very slippery and the soils come off the dishes. It's really the same idea with fabrics.
But then it also has to make sure that the tomato sauce, which is now diluted in my washing machine, doesn't get back onto my shirt.
Correct. And so the other role of the surfactants is to keep it suspended.
Huh.
It needs to keep the soil suspended in the wash water, which becomes more and more difficult. Because now, since there is a movement to high-efficiency machines, there's a lot less water. So you have to suspend more soil in a lot less water.
And when you say soil, that could be?
Tomato sauce, clays, oils, grease, food, you name it.
Dirt.
Dirt.
Okay. Wow, that's really complicated. What were your toughest stains when you were doing this work? What were the stains you hated the most?
The toughest stains are grease, mm-hmm. oil stains that are embedded in cotton, because they get embedded in the cotton microstructure and it's hard to get them out. They can't find their way out. And so they just keep redepositing within the cotton microstructure. They're very difficult.
Then I showed Curtis my daughter's uniform shirt with all of those weird stains on it. And it's, of course, 100% cotton.
I see. Some of them are, that one looks a little yellow. So can I ask a question?
Sure.
Did you add use a liquid laundry detergent?
Yes.
Did you add it directly to the?
Probably.
Right onto the fabric?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay.
Is that a no-no?
Well, what you want to avoid
mm-hmm.
is you want the detergent to dissolve into the water. Sometimes if you put it directly on white clothes, you have a lot of detergent in one place, and you could get spots from anything. Did you try to wash it again?
Oh, yeah. I've washed it like 100 times. Yeah.
It's not coming out.
Nope.
And it went through the dryer, so it's set in. Okay.
Okay. Here's our laundry lesson summary. Try to retreat a stain before you put something in the dryer. Otherwise, it will get baked in even more. Don't pour the detergent directly on clothes, especially white cotton, because undiluted, some of the ingredients could cause stains. And then Curtis says, another suspect for these spots on my daughter's shirt is a leave-in conditioner I used to detangle her hair. He suggested I should take the shirt to the dry cleaners.
Because they wash in solvents that you're not going to have in your house.
This shirt is totally not worth it, but at this point, I'm committed. I want to pursue this for science.
Morning. How are you?
The dry cleaner said she would give it a shot, but she didn't look too hopeful, and sure enough.
So I just had this dry cleaned, and now what does it look like?
The same.
Yeah. All the same spots.
We're talking about the science of everyday things, what our objects tell us about discovery and innovation.
If you look at something like your cell phone and you pull that out of your pocket, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of different technologies that are at work making all of the different systems functional.
Ben Gross is a science historian at the Linda Hall Library in Kansas City, and the technology that fascinates him most about cell phones is the screen. Those screens are not just in phones, they are in televisions and huge ads flashing at football stadiums or at Times Square. They trace their origins to a famous company.
RCA, the most trusted name in television.
RCA in the 1950s and 1960s was probably the leader in American consumer electronics. If you owned a radio or a television, you probably owned an RCA TV, or at least you had heard about them.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is an historic day in the history of electronics, and we bring you a report on color.
They pioneered the first black and white and color television systems in the United States and the color broadcasting standard that we used up until 2009.
Now, other questions? How soon will I have color in my home?
So RCA was really one of the leading firms in the United States when it came to electronics and innovation.
I saw color TV, RCA Victor color TV.
Ben writes about this history in his new book, The TVs of Tomorrow. In the 1950s, the longtime leader of RCA, David Sarnoff, pushed his engineers to envision the future of television. Remember, at the time, TVs were heavy, big, and bulky, and that was because TV technology relied on an electron beam to produce an image.
A television picture tube essentially created an image by shooting a beam of electrons across a phosphor-coated screen. And the trick was that you couldn't shoot electrons through the air. You needed to have a vacuum inside the tube. So you would have essentially a very large tube with an electrode, they called it a cathode.
These tubes were literally weighing televisions down, and the RCA chairman wanted something different, something light and skinny.
That you could hang on the wall like a painting.
They needed to find a way to produce an image without the tube, and 10 years later, they had a start, liquid crystals.
These materials have their strange name because they have a unique set of properties. Liquid crystals can flow like a liquid. They can pour from one container to another. They'll take the shape of whatever container you put them into. But they have the optical properties of a crystalline solid. So light will pass through it and be affected much like a crystal will. What they discovered at RCA during the mid-1960s was that certain kinds of liquid crystals had a particular electro-optic property. If you applied an electric field across them, they would reflect light. And they would actually scatter light if you applied enough voltage onto it. And it's actually a really striking effect. Imagine a clear piece of glass, and then suddenly you flip a switch, and you can see a bright white test pattern on it.
And were they thinking of this for television?
Initially, they were thinking about it in terms of simpler applications, things like wristwatches or calculators. They actually demonstrated in 1968 the first liquid crystal clock, a digital clock without any moving parts whatsoever.
So no hands, no...
No hands. No hands and no gears or clockwork inside. This was entirely electronic, and they were very proud of that. And they said that eventually they might come up with a way that you could turn this into a television display. They were able to prove that you could switch these individual liquid crystal cells on and off as quickly as you needed to for a television screen, because you needed to refresh the image quickly enough to make it look like it was moving. But they said that it would be very difficult to do that.
LCDs slowly, over decades, made their way into computers and portable gaming systems, and then finally into televisions.
By 2008, which was just 10 years ago, right? For the first time, liquid crystal display-based televisions, LCD televisions, were outselling traditional cathode ray tube sets.
Today, LCD screens light up our smartphones and our world, bombarding us with information and advertisements everywhere we go. But RCA was long gone before all that happened.
What's amazing is that although RCA was the first company to announce that you could use liquid crystals in a display, they ultimately were unable to commercialize the technology.
Ben Gross is a science historian and the author of The TVs of Tomorrow, How RCA's Flat-Screen Dreams Led to the First LCDs. Science alters the design of things all the time, whether we're talking about TVs or toilets. Toilets and bathrooms changed dramatically based on what science taught us about the spread of disease. Public health historian Michael Udell has more.
In the late 1800s, scientists began to rapidly identify the bacteria responsible for some of history's most horrible killers. Tuberculosis, typhoid, cholera. Historians often call that time the bacteriological revolution. Central to this change in thinking was germ theory. That's the idea that some diseases are caused by tiny microorganisms entering the body. And the more scientists learned about germs, the more they started to think about where those germs came from. The outdoor privy and the family chamber pots were culprits, but so too was the indoor bathroom, found more commonly in fancy Victorian homes. Before the bacteriological revolution, public health leaders, they were called sanitarians back then, were focused on the dangers of sewer gases drifting up through the pipes. They worried that the putrid gas could harm your great-great-great-grandfather's health as he sat on the toilet reading the Sunday paper. But after the bacteriological revolution, fears about sewer gases gave way to concerns about germs collecting in bathrooms. One casualty of this war on germs was the opulent bathroom. Because what late 19th century home wasn't complete without a bathroom with drapes, wood cabinets, and carpets? That's right, carpeted bathrooms. Ew. The bacteriological revolution would flush out carpets, drapes, and porous wood cabinetry in favor of freestanding white porcelain toilets. Tile floors and porcelain sinks and showers would eventually become mainstays. And to make sure that your white toilet didn't have any streaks, engineers also came up with a more powerful flush to efficiently dispose of waste. In the new porcelain-filled bathroom, there was nowhere for germs to hide, and the bathroom became a centerpiece in the war on germs. On average, people flush 6 to 7 times per day. So next time you do, remember that our fear of germs and some pretty gross carpeting helped make the bathroom what it is today.
That's Michael Udell from Drexel University in Philadelphia, and much of the research for his story comes from Nancy Tome's book, The Gospel of Germs. Speaking of germs, we got a question from a listener. Here's Mike from Riverton, New Jersey.
I'm a big fan of recycling. I recently bought some stainless steel straws. However, my wife heard something about being prone to build up on the inside. Is that a potential problem?
Good question. Do mold and bacteria hide inside of your fancy stainless steel straw? We reached out to Rebecca Ferkser. She's the culinary editor at Extra Crispy. That's a website about breakfast and brunch. And she says she's a clean freak.
You never know what's lurking inside of your straw.
Rebecca says just rinsing the straw off probably won't cut it.
Obviously, there's, you know, bacteria that can get in there.
Instead, she recommends using a straw brush. Yes, that's a thing.
The best way I can describe them is like a very thin toothbrush with bristles kind of around the top inch or two. So you put a little drop of dish soap onto the brush, add a little bit of water and get it sudsy, and then you just stick it into your straw and, you know, move the brush up and down. Just go to town, and then you'd want to wash the outside of the straw with hot water and a sponge and dish soap, just like you would anything else.
And if you don't have a straw brush, Rebecca says you can make one using pipe cleaners. Thank you for the info, Rebecca, and thanks, Mike, for your question. If you have a question or a comment or want to weigh in for a future episode, we always love to hear from you. Check out our website, whyy.org/thepulse, and get in touch. Today's show is about the hidden science of everyday objects, phones, bikes, carpets. So we've been talking about these things, but there's a new podcast where the objects talk to us.
Well, let's just start, settle in, have you introduce yourself for us.
My name is Lewis, and I am a can of GoTo Cola.
That's a store brand.
Mm-hmm. GoTo, G-O-2, Cola.
So it's similar to Coca-Cola.
Similar. People call it a knockoff. I've been called the best of the worst.
Audio producer Ian Chillag tapes conversations with everyday objects for his podcast, Everything is Alive. The objects are played by actors. He says the idea comes in part from his longtime work as a public radio producer, always looking for experts.
You know, there's a story about, you know, the banana trade. And so you're supposed to find the world's leading expert on bananas. And I just, somewhere along the way, I had this idea, well, what if you were able to find the kind of ultimate primary source and talk to the banana itself?
Or the can of cola. Here's some more from Everything is Alive.
So you I take it, you were in a supermarket?
Yep.
And where were you?
I was in a Safeway. I was bought at a Case. So there were 24 of us. We were all purchased together. And actually, our next residence was a bowling alley for a 12-year-old's birthday party. I saw most of the rest of my case drunk at that party. I was not drunk. I was saved for later and brought home and put into a refrigerator and then forgotten about for a few months, placed in the back of the fridge.
Sure.
Ian says his conversations with objects seem to make listeners weirdly empathetic to the stuff in their lives.
Well, occasionally people have written in and said, you know, I can't have Diet Coke anymore. And I try to tell them that Lewis, our can of cola, forgives them.
And this is something we all do on occasion, right? Talk to our stuff.
I guess if I have a pen that doesn't work, I'll yell at it.
And I curse at it.
Why aren't you working?
Threw you in the trash there.
Yes, I talked to my car. Her name is Sloan. Oh, this is what you want to do, Sloan? You got it.
I talked to the oven, the stove. When I'm trying to put it on, I said, what's wrong with you? Don't you see I'm trying to get you?
Lexi Blue, let's go. Lexi Blue, come to me. That's me. I talk to my car.
Encouraging your car to drive faster or calling your phone out for being cranky. Why do we do that? I mean, we know these things don't have a brain or a personality.
Well, it seems to stem, as far as we can tell, from the very same kinds of psychological processes that allow me to sometimes recognize that you have a personality and that you're sometimes cranky and that you have feelings.
That's psychologist Nicholas Epley. He says we're wired to do this with our fellow humans, to get into their heads, figure out what they're doing and what they'll do next. Let's say you see me walking down the street, just walking normally, minding my business. You're probably not going to try to figure out what I'm thinking.
But if you were to skip down the sidewalk or jump from one side to another, behave somewhat unusually, then I would wonder, well, why is she doing that?
And sometimes that same figuring it out process is triggered around an object if it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing. Let's say your microwave starts beeping for no reason, or your phone screen is suddenly flashing, then
you might start to think about intentions or motives or desires. And so objects that behave somewhat unpredictably are ones that we need to explain, and we tend to explain things by appealing to their minds.
We also anthropomorphize objects when we like them or spend a lot of time with them. Do you think companies tap into that desire of ours to attribute minds and personalities to objects? You know, I'm thinking about on my laptop when it's closed, there's that little light that sort of goes in and out, and it looks like the computer is sleeping. Do they do that kind of thing on purpose?
Yeah, so they very much do. So marketers know that we tend to attribute minds to things that don't have them, and so they might present things as if they're in a family group in an ad, even though, you know, bottles of wine cannot be a family. Nevertheless, we might attribute those sort of human-like familial relationships to them. Car manufacturers notoriously create grills on the front of a car that resemble human-like faces, to convey a particular kind of personality or image to a buyer. So a pickup truck is more likely to have a grill that looks like a snarl compared to, say, a friendly little VW bug that looks more like a smile.
Could all of this get more confusing as our objects become smarter and they're talking to us, they have voices?
Absolutely. Gadgets and devices are getting much smarter. They're starting to behave more independently. They're learning. They're doing lots of the things that human minds are capable of doing and more. So the distinction between what is actually human and what is not is blurring in lots of ways.
So anthropomorphizing that kind of object might not be a brain slip.
When I think that my phone is actually smart, you know, in some ways it is intelligent.
Nicholas Epley is a psychologist and professor of behavior science at the University of Chicago. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Andy Copes is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.